when I first thought of speaking on what a woman can do, so many things that were in my mind, Mrs. Downing brought out yesterday, that I thought I would just touch briefly and go on to Africa instead. But as a very young Christian, I can remember bemoaning very much the fact that I wasn't a man. It seemed to me there would have been so much greater opportunities for Christian service if I'd just been a man. It's amazing what 50 years will do with the thinking of people, because now they take quite a different attitude toward many avenues of service for a woman than they did even that short a time ago. But I've learned through the years that God has a ministry for each one as an individual. And I don't believe God stresses man or woman or this particular position more than another. It was foreordained before the creation of the world that we should serve him and be to the praise of his glory. And if he's given us the place of complementing a man's service, completing a man, why then I think we should rejoice in that opportunity and be happy to be a helpmeet to a man. And I think thinking people realize that back of every prominent man, there is the influence of a woman, if not his wife, his mother, and others. But I think more and more we're realizing what a large part in the ministry the pastor's wife plays. There's so many things that a pastor can't do, even though he's the leader in the church. He's the one that's seen. It just doesn't seem appropriate that a pastor invite the confidences of the young women of the congregation, and he's sure to be criticized if he does. But oh, his wife can be such a blessing and help. And it's an amazing thing in this day how few wives are willing to go calling with their husbands or willing to make any effort to be prepared for counseling the young people. But it's all part of God's plan and purpose and is needed to complete the ministry. It isn't very long ago when I came in, my sister was looking at the program, I think it was from Atlantic City, The Crowning of Miss America. I was weary. I sat down and was looking at it. I got in just the place where the five finals were being announced, and the next was the talent section. I don't remember who the various ones were, but there was one thing that impressed me. A very beautiful young woman, very talented. When it came to the part where, I guess they were testing them for extemporaneous speaking and so forth, they asked this one woman the question of who perhaps had been the greatest influence in her life and helped her the most. She thought for barely a moment, and she says, my pastor's wife. She says, much of the inspiration and help and encouragement in my life has come through my pastor's wife. And I thought that was quite an unusual testimony for a beauty queen of some state that was seeking to be Miss America. And I just thought, well, I hope if there are any pastor's wives listening in, that's an encouragement to know that they do have a very vital part in God's ministry. And I found that much that the Lord used in my ministry was things that I never would have thought of as any ministry. Never would have dreamt he could have used. And I tell you about one now. It was always a burden on my heart that there were so many of the French people in Africa that weren't being reached by the gospel at all. And you know, we had a lot of missionaries that took the attitude they didn't care. God called them to minister to the black man, and the French be hanged. Well, they had a form of religion, a form of godliness. Many of them were great idol worshippers, but they knew nothing of the power of God unto salvation. And yet, what opportunity did we missionaries have to mingle with them or to witness to them? You can't just walk up to a high official and ask him if he's saved or begin trying to witness to him. He just put you down as, well, perhaps a nitwit. And he wouldn't listen to your testimony anyhow. God's so wonderful and gracious, he could overrule and use it in spite of all. But I don't believe that's his method very often. But how were we, and especially how was I, a woman, ever going to get to witness to the French? Well, I committed it to the Lord. Never thought of it being an answer. One day, it so happened we'd had letters from three different missionaries telling us that we were getting a new chef de région. That was the chief administrator at Bombay, which was the seat of the government of our province. And they said, watch out for him. He's a stickler, and he's no use for missionaries. We've had more run-ins with him and more trouble. Watch out for him. They didn't explain what it was or how or why. I wish they'd never written those letters, because it made me dread the time that we'd have anything to do with him. And you never know when you might. But there one day, just 12:05, somebody knocked at the door, and I went, and there was a Frenchman I'd never seen before. He introduced himself as a new chef de région from Bombay. Was making his rounds and was at a bit for the day. What was there to do but to invite him in? The table was all set. Great big doorway, just a little bit of wall waste to separate the living room from the dining room. He could see it all. I'd even started to put the food on the table. My husband ate by the clock. I had breakfast exactly at 7:00. I had dinner exactly at noon and supper at 5:30 every day. I knew he would be there ready to sit down at 12:00. So I thought, now what do you do? Well, I said, we're just about ready to sit down to our new meal. Would you join us? Why, yes, I'd be happy to. Just then the children all came in, my husband, introductions were made, and we sat down at the table. I didn't want to embarrass my husband, asking him to give thanks in French, so I had one of the children give thanks. We proceeded. Then when things were being passed, you know, the French don't eat like we do at all. There wasn't time to change, and my husband had no patience with change, and he didn't have time to drag out into courses. So we were passing. Well, I didn't know, but it so happened this gentleman had lived 1.5 years in Chicago, and he knew how Americans ate, so I was thankful I hadn't tried doing something different. But you know, the French always wind up after their meat course with a salad, and salad to them is lettuce with vinegar and oil dressing tossed. That must come next. Then comes bread and cheese or a fruit and cheese. Well, we didn't have any lettuce in the garden. So I'd made slaw. I didn't know that Frenchmen ever had eaten raw cabbage. So I passed the slaw. "What's this, Mrs. Laird?" I said, "It's a cabbage salad." "Raw?" I says, "Yes, we rather enjoy it in America." "Well, in France, pigs eat things like that." I thought for a moment. He watched everybody else helping themselves. He said, "Well, I guess if you eat it all the time, it won't kill me." So he took a helping. He tasted it. "Have you got any vinegar?" I got out the vinegar cruet, fixed it up to suit himself, and he said, "Why, this is good." He took 3 helpings of it. We visited. When he got up to go, I said, "I hope any time you're in Ippy, you'll honor us by stepping in." And he says, "Well, I don't know when I'll ever be back again." He said, "I'm leaving next week for France. That's why I'm making my rounds now." I was rather surprised. I said, "Well, I thought you'd just arrived." "Oh, well, you see, this isn't a regular furlough. I'm flying to Paris to be married next week." And I said, "Oh, congratulations." I was a bit surprised because it's what I would have called a middle-aged man already. I didn't know but what he'd had a wife and family and all, though he hadn't mentioned any. Then he says, "Well, lady, I don't know whether I need your congratulations or your sympathy." Well, that sounded funny for a bridegroom. He says, "You see, it's like this. My very first furlough, I got engaged to 2 girls." He said, "Don't ask me how I did it. I've never been able to figure it out." But he said, "Neither one of them would release me. So for 28 years, I've been engaged to 2 young women. And I've never gone back to Paris." And he said, "Last week I had news one of them died. So," he said, "I'm going to Paris to marry the other." So I said, "Well, that's lovely." "Well, I'm not so sure of that. It's the one I thought I was in love with that died." Well, I didn't have anything further to say. And I says, "Well, when you return with your bride, I hope I have the pleasure of meeting her." "Oh, you will." Well, he was gone so long, and I forgot all about him. Missionaries are such busy people, they don't have time to think about such things or plan for such things at all. Here one day, about 4:30, there were 4 French folks arrived, 2 couples. And I went, and Mr. Reddy presented his new bride. Of course, she wasn't a sweet young thing. She was on middle age, too. But the administrator that he'd come to place at E.P. was a young man with a very lovely young wife. And I thought, my goodness, here are 2 brides, and I ought to be having something special to serve them, and I don't have a thing in the house, not a cookie, not a piece of cake. I could get by without serving anything if I had a cold drink, but we didn't have an ice box, and I didn't have any cold water on the premise. There was nothing to do but make tea. But you feel kind of silly serving a cup of hot tea without anything to go with it. While we were visiting, I thought, "Oh, it's time to take the bread out the oven." And I went out. Our kitchen sat about a half block away from the house, because we just had grass roofs in those days. I went out and brought in the bread. By the time I got to the back brand, all 4 of them were standing in the back door. "Is that fresh bread we smell? That smelt like Paris." So I put down the bread. "Oh, can we have some?" Well, happily, I had a sawtooth knife. I got out the knife and I cut up a whole loaf. I set it on the table and went in, meant to get the other things, because they never sit down to the table for tea. They always serve it in the living room. But by the time I came out of the pantry, they'd all found themselves a place at the table and were seated. So I opened a jar of marmalade and put the marmalade on the tea and served. And you know, they never stopped till they ate that whole loaf of bread. Well, when they come to go, Mr. Reddy stepped back at the others. And he said, say, if my wife came and spent a week with you, do you think you could teach her to make tea bread like that? Well, I was horrified. Before I thought, I said, oh, it wouldn't take her a week at all. She could learn in a couple hours. And I thought, oh my, that didn't sound very hospitable. I said, oh, if your wife could spend a week with me, I could teach her to make lots of things. Fine, I'll bring her next week. Well, she came next week. I won't tell you all the nightmares I had the remainder of that week. Well, it wasn't bad at all. She was so interested. The only trouble I had, she happened to be as cross-eyed as anything. And I never knew when she was watching what I was showing her. She was examining something about the house. Anyhow, the time passed. I taught her to make marmalade and pie jam and guava jelly and several different kinds of breads and cakes and ginger snaps and the simpler things that we could make with what we had to do with. She was delighted when her husband came to take her. Well, sometime after that, we were in Bombay on official business. We had to go to his office. So he said, well, we've been wondering when you'd come to Bombay. He said, you must stay over night so my wife can have you to dinner. I'll invite in several others. Well, we didn't want to, but we didn't want to refuse either, and we couldn't possibly get away in time to get back to Hippy before night. We were down to oversee work at an outstation that we had right there in Bunbury. So we decided to stay overnight, and we went to the mansion for dinner. Well, here he'd invited the new doctor and his wife, an administrator from Greenmore and his wife and others till we were 14 at the table. Well, his wife didn't know anything about informal entertaining. And I think she had spent the 28 years working on her hope chest. I never saw so much beautiful embroidery work and things needlepoint and the rest around the place. Great long table, but she had a linen tablecloth long enough for it. But it was embroidered with grapes, clusters of grapes. And I tell you, she had patted those grapes so you had to watch where you sat down, a glass or a spoon, or you had it on the floor. Well, she was one of these kind at the doorway before a boy came in. There was the basin he had to wash his hands each time with soap. And there was the towel and all. With my boys, I made him little khaki shorts and a white butcher apron and tried to keep them clean. But I wish you'd seen hers. They had white tuxedos, little black bow ties, stiff collars, looked like the Met Hotel in Paris. And they were trained to wait on that table, I tell you. But everything was so stiff and formal, everybody was in misery. Every conversation died before it got started. But we finally got down to the dessert course. Mr. Reddy stood up and raised his glass and proposed a toast to his bride that was going to be the best cook in the colony, thanks to Madame Laird. The poor bride was blushing like everything. He said she has made this dessert herself. She got up and went out. Well, of course, I didn't know what he had said. We were having American tea bread and marmalade for dessert. Well, she evidently hadn't planned to have the marmalade. She was going to have pie jam. So she stepped out on the back veranda to give the boy the orders. In a little bit, in comes the boy with a beautiful silver tray. On the silver tray, a very elaborate embroidered doily. On that, a cut glass dish, fully 3/4 of an inch thick, a beautiful thing. In that, another embroidered doily. And in the midst of that, a tin can rested all around, put a label on it with a picture of an orange. The top had been cut out with a jagged thing, the top standing up like that, and the other side a beautiful silver spoon. Well, of course, we were all rather taken back. When the bride looked up and saw that, she gave one gasp and started to cry. Then she started shouting to her husband, "Kill him! Kill him!" And I, like a ninny, broke out laughing like everything. My husband gave me a good kick under the table, and I laughed the harder. About the time Mr. Eddy got up, and I didn't know what he might be going to do to that boy, I said, "Wait a minute, let me explain." He says, "Do you think there can be an explanation for such a thing?" I said, "Yes." I said, "Your wife stepped out on the back veranda and told the boy not to put on the pie jam to get the marmalade. And to be sure he would understand marmalade, because naturally the woman didn't speak anything but French. And natives have, some of them that have worked for the French, have a sketchy idea of French. She said, "You know that can of jam I brought out from Paris, we had for breakfast the first week I came? That's what I mean." Well, it had clicked, the can I brought out from Paris with a picture of the orange on it. He'd gone out back of the kitchen to the dump and found that can and put the marmalade in it and served it. Well, then, of course, they all started to laugh. And the poor woman was so embarrassed. Happily, the doctor's wife spoke up. And she said, "Let me tell you what happened to me the first big dinner I gave when I came as a bride to the colony." She said, "I wanted to make my husband so proud of me, I worked all day." She said, "I didn't have any more sense than to plan the most elaborate menu I could think of." Tête de veau is a very favorite dish of the French. I never bothered trying to make it. It was plain repulsive to me. It's the head of a calf, and it's cooked almost hours with the feet of the calf and all to get the jelly, the gelatin out. So when they take the head out and it's all tender and all, they strain all the herbs and things they've added to the juice. They strain all of those out and pour this in a fancy mold, and there's enough gelatin from the calf's feet that it gels. And she thought she'd succeeded beautifully. And she had it on a big tray, fixed up with the jello mold, the clear gelatin all around it, and made rosebuds of radishes and all. And she had some persil frise. That's parsley, but theirs is so much more curled and so much fuller than ours. She had it in a little bowl of ice water beside it. And she said, "Now when it's time to serve this, you shake the parsley out of the water well and put a real nice full sprig in each nostril and bring it in." So after a while, in comes the boy, but he's shuffling along. They turn and look at him, and he has the platter out in front, but his head way back like this, so he won't drop the parsley out of his nostrils. Well, by that time, everybody was laughing. Well, then every woman there wanted to tell some experience it had. Well, the ice was broken. Everybody thoroughly enjoyed. She had succeeded beautifully with her tea bread. And her marmalade was very good when she went and got another jar of it. And everything passed, and before you knew it, it was 10 minutes to midnight. And there we were still sitting at the table visiting. Why do I tell you that? There were high officials and the doctor's wife and others there that I never would have had opportunity to meet. But I was invited into every one of those homes as a special guest. I had opportunity to witness to every one of those. My husband in his preaching ministry or teaching ministry could never have reached those folks. It didn't take any great talent. I can't sing. I can't play. I've nothing that we normally think of as accomplishments. But I am a good cook. And God used that simple ability to teach her to please her husband with good food, to open the door, not only to them, but word passes around in the colony to many. Even the governor himself, when he was having a big state dinner, sent and wanted to know if I would make some clover leaf rolls and a layer cake, if he would send a car to get them for the dinner, when I'd never met him. So afterwards, he made a special visit to my home to thank me for it. You see, quite often God uses the simple things that a woman can do to make contacts. And so I learned to thank God for the simple responsibility of being a woman, a wife, and a mother in the home. I tell you of one other. I'd like to read just a few verses in Titus. The second chapter. I always loved the Pauline epistles, and especially the ones to Timothy and Titus. I began reading these often way back when this chapter began, and for the aged women to teach the women to love their husbands and their children. And I used to think, I wonder if I'll ever have a husband. Will I ever have a children? If God gives me a husband, nobody will have to teach me to love him. Nobody will have to teach me to love my children. And then the next thing I knew, I was in the class of the aged women. But just recently, as I was reading this chapter again, well, it dawned on me, all the while I belonged in the last category and didn't have sense enough to know it. Exhort servants to be obedient unto their own masters and to please them well in all things, not answering again, not purloining, that's cheating, but showing all good fidelity, that they may adorn the doctrine of God our Savior in all things. For the grace of God that bringeth salvation hath appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world, looking for that blessed hope and the glorious appearing of the great God and our Savior Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us, that it might redeem us from all iniquity, and purify unto himself a peculiar people, zealous of good works. These things speak and exhort, and rebuke with all authority. Let no man despise thee. There's a thought of that, it seemed so peculiar to me, that it was in the exhortation to servants to adorn the doctrine of God. And I thought, how foolish. How could anybody possibly adorn the doctrine of God? What does adorn mean? To make more beautiful, to make attractive. Well, is there anything that could be more perfect than the doctrine of God? And then to exhort the servants. Well, I put it down as one of the things that's beyond my understanding. Then one day, as I was thinking of some of the simple African servants that have been a great blessing to me, I was thinking of one African woman, a Janali. It was such a blessing. And I thought, well, if anyone ever adorned the doctrine of God, Janali did. and I'd like to tell you about her. She was a Sara. The Saras are from the Chad. That's to the northwest of us. They're quite a different people than the Bandas. They're a big people. Most of them will stand 6 feet or better. I've known many of them to be 7 feet tall. Big, strong, viral-looking people in comparison to our Bandas. And in both the First and Second World War, the French used many of them in their military service. And so it was that many of them spoke French and had been to Europe. Then when they came back, the French used them for soldiers in the colony. This one Sara had been sent to Ipi as a soldier. He had taken a bride from his own tribe before he came. And they had lived in the soldier settlement at Ipi. It's behind a high brick wall. Civilians aren't permitted there. I've never been in that camp in my life. But our native evangelist and pastor was allowed in there and went every week for meetings. And it was he that brought Shamali to me. When there came a time, she was left a widow. According to the culture of the land, a woman is the possession of her husband. He buys her, some sections with cattle, and ours it was so many goats and so much money. I was telling you how they celebrate funerals. Nobody celebrates a wedding. Some of them begin when they're mere youngsters. When they get a goat, they make a down payment toward their bride. Some of them get her paid for by the time they're 9 or 10 years old and go and take her. She has no life of her own. The Arabs think she has no soul. And so she's just the possession of a man. And if the husband dies, then his uncle is the one that inherits her. If the uncle's dead, his oldest brother gets her. He either takes her as another wife or takes and sells her again. Well, Shamali had had a letter from a brother-in-law saying for her to walk back to their Kodro, and he would marry her or sell her. Well, her Kodro was 850 miles away. She had no desire to walk back there. She didn't remember anybody back in her village. She'd raised two daughters that were married in our district, and she would rather be near them. She had one girl, about 13 years old, still at home with her. She asked Mananga what she should do. Would she have to go back? He didn't know what to counsel her. And he says, my white mama's a widow. Would you go up with me and talk with her? And so she came. We talked about it. I talked with her and had the joy of leading her to the Lord. Shamali said she would love to stay and learn more. I said, I tell you, I'll help you build a house just across the road from our mission, and you can come to the classes. So she did. One day Shamali came. She was crying. I said, Shamali, what's the matter? She was used to such a very cheerful thing. She said, last night, when I went home from your class, I got to thinking, I've brought three girls into the world. If anything should happen to them and they go to hell, how could I be happy in glory? She said, I don't know what to do. And I said, Shamali, just keep on praying for them. Witness to them. Oh, but she said, I have, and they don't want to listen. She says, you don't understand. They married Arabs that are Mohammedans. They don't want them to come to the chapel. They don't want me to read from the Bible. Well, I said, Shamali, all I know to do is to pray. I said, if you want to come up in the afternoon before I go down the women's class. I have 15 minutes. If you want to come up exactly on time, we'll pray together about it. So she did and seemed to have peace. Time went on. Neither one of the daughters came. There seemed to be no evidence that there was any real working or answer to prayer. Then I said, Janelle, maybe the Lord will have to make them sick that they have to come to the dispensary or something. And so we prayed that that could be God's will. He'd bring it to pass. Then it happened. A Thursday morning, that was shop day. When you have so many people, you can't begin to give each one the individual time and take care of everything that comes along in one day and all. And so I'd learned to arrange my time. There were certain days for diagnosis. Any day there was time for emergencies and all. But when they were finally sifted out, Tuesday and Thursday were for shots. A very large percentage of the people had syphilis. This was before the days that we had penicillin or any of the miracle-working drugs. And they had to have 2 shots a week for months before they were cured. Well, this daughter had syphilis. I didn't know who she was at all. But that morning, when they were standing in line, they came up. I was just ready. I was surprised. She had on a lot of clothes. Most of my patients don't. In fact, one time when I said how many patients I took care of, in the morning, there was a young lady came up after the service and she said to me, I happen to be an RN. And she said, I know it's a physical impossibility to do what you said you did. I was rather taken back. Nobody had ever faced me that way before. I said, have you ever nursed in Africa? Well, of course not, but nursing is nursing wherever it is. Well, there's no use of arguing with folks like that. I didn't try. But I thought, well, there can be a vast difference. The women wore a tassel of raffia in front. Mensa's time, they wear leaves. Otherwise, raffia. Another tassel in back. Both buttocks are out bare. The men have bark cloth. The women wear a string of beads around their waist with this turned over. Men have a strip of leather around their waist with the bark cloth turned over. Older men wear the bark cloth and clear down to their ankles. Younger men just wear a short little apron affair of it. Both buttocks always bare. Well, they stand in this long line. I have my table out on the veranda at the dispensary, and as they come, there's one basin with green soap solution. There's a basin of water. There's a basin of 55% alcohol. Then there's my basin of sterile hypos, needles, and a contaminated basin. And as I said, many of them are for syphilis injections. So I just fill a 5cc syringe and just put a new needle on each time. And wash them off, pull them, and the next one, just move along. It's amazing how fast you can go through a couple blocks of people that way. But here was this one all dressed up. And I says, hold your skirt up over your shoulders like this. And here there was another one underneath. So I put it up and told her, hold it. And there, bless, that was bloomers. Well, it was years since I'd seen a pair of bloomers. Had elastic around the top and elastic around here. I pushed it down. There was another pair. I don't know where their idea is, putting everything they own on at once, but quite often you'll find it so. So I said, all right, you put your other hand around here to hold this elastic down so nothing touches when I wash your bottom. Fix it. Yes. I got her all fixed. I started washing with the green soap. Down drops the skirt, up pings the elastic of her bloomers. I was a bit disgusted, but we went all through it again. Accidents happen anywhere. That time I got as far as the alcohol, and I guess it was cold, or she got scared. She turned, she grabbed my hand, and grabbed the hypo out of my hand. And I don't know why, but it thoroughly provoked me. Before I had time to think, my hand was empty instead of with that prepared hypo. I raised it and brought it down with a good ping on her bottom. She turned around and looked at me, absolutely startled. And I was just as startled as she was. I'd never done anything like that before. But just on the impulse of the moment, I'd given her a real brisk slap. Well, she started to cry. And I said, "You go on." "No, I want my shot." I said, "I haven't time to bother with the likes of you." She had insisted I take her inside and put a screen around her. She'd seen me do it with a French woman once. So I did all that, too. So the whole string of them outside didn't see all this. But I put her out on the back porch, and still she kept hollering and wailing. I closed the back door, and I went out to the front to go on with my work. But I was kind of nervous and trembly over it all. Things went slower. I didn't finish till 1:45 that day. By the time I got up to the house, all the boys had gone. There was no food left on the table. I had 15 minutes till time to go to class. And I was too tired to begin looking for food. And I thought, well, I'll go out the kitchen, see if there's any boiling water on. I'll have a cup of coffee and get on down to class. Here I come in the backyard, stood Janali crying. I said, "Janali, what's the matter?" "Oh, Mama, you know how we've prayed that my daughter would come to the dispensary." Just like that, it went all over me. It was that dressed-up woman. And she said, "And she came this morning. And she said, you beat her and threw her out and wouldn't give her any medicine." And I said, "Oh, Janali, I gave her a good smart slap, but I didn't beat her. I told her she came back Tuesday morning with one pair of pants and one skirt and could hold them out of the way. I'd give her a shot." She cried. She begged me to go back down with her and give her her shot then. I said, "I can't do it, Shanali. I have to maintain a certain discipline. I'd do most anything for you or to reach your daughter, but I can't do that." I said, "All I know to do is to pray the Lord will overrule." So I brought her in with me, and we knelt and prayed. Then I hurried down to class. Sure enough, Tuesday morning, the daughter was in line, one pair of bloomers and one skirt, and she held them out of the way. Well, we have a loudspeaker going. We have a gospel service at 7 o'clock before I start giving out medication. And then during the time, there's a loudspeaker going with the native pastor giving a message and verses in Sango and French and singing. I have four boys that I've trained to mingle with the patients as they wait to witness to them. The daughter found Christ. Janali was so happy. But still, there were two that didn't know him. And the second one, she said, would never come. She was married to the principal cobbler of the district, a very strong Arab. She said, "The last time I was there, she put me out of the house and told me never to come back again." Well, it wasn't very long. They brought her in the hammock. We didn't have any stretchers then. They'd take a hunting hammock, their feet up here and their head up there, the net tied on the bamboo, and carry them in that way. She looked very sick. A long string of people from the village followed because they thought she was dying. They all want to be the first to see them die and to start turning somersaults. I took her to a little bamboo bed in one of my sick huts right across the road. I examined her. I couldn't find what in the world was the matter. Blood pressure was normal. Pulse seemed normal. And yet here she lay as if she were dead. Well, her poor mother was crying her eyes out, felt so badly, I thought I had to do something. I gave her a heart stimulant. And then I proceeded all over again, trying to find out what was the matter. And as I knelt by her bed and prayed, the Lord seemed to tell me she was demon-possessed. I've seen lots of people that are demon-possessed. We have missionaries that make a practice of casting out demons, go from village to village to look for them. I've been too afraid of them for anything like that, and I never thought of having power to cast out demons. But I felt led to lay my hand on her forehead and pray and ask Christ to deliver her. Just as I prayed, she raised up in bed and raised both hands and gave the most horrible, blood-curdling shriek you ever heard. Then she dropped back on the bed just as if she was dead. The women started the death wail. They started turning somersaults and carrying on. I took her pulse, perfectly normal. I slapped her face a little bit. Her eyelids fluttered. In a minute she sat up. She says, "Tell me about Jesus." Her mother was so surprised. While I was talking, her mother come with her open testament wanting to talk to her. And it wasn't very long. She said, "I want to ask him to come into my heart." I prayed and she prayed. I wish you could have seen the difference in that woman, just rejoicing in the Lord. Then she told us that when her mother came to see her that last time, she was so deeply under conviction, it made her so mad. She said, "I shoved my mother out of the house and told her never to come back. And then I was ashamed of myself." And she said, "I had such turmoil in my heart. I decided I'd better go out and sacrifice." So she said, "I got a nice white rooster. And I went out to the woods to the devil's altar. And I sacrificed my rooster." She said, "I didn't have any peace. So I threw myself across that altar and asked the devil to accept me as a sacrifice, to be his servant the rest of my life." And she said, "Then it happened to me just like now." She said, "It was a couple hours before I was able to get up or to walk to come home. Several times this has come when I've been in the village, but nobody was around. But today," she said, "all these people were there and they thought I was dying." And I thought, how full of grace our God is. The defiance of that young woman, whose mother had wept over her, had pled with her, and given her the gospel, to go out and offer herself a sacrifice to the devil. And yet God in his mercy saved her. And through that, the younger girl accepted Christ. Shanali's heart was just overflowing with praise. But it wasn't very long she came to me one day. She says, "Mama, my money's all gone, my salt's all gone. Isn't there something I can do to earn a bit of salt?" That may sound funny to you folks, but you know the staple article of food of the Africans is gozo. That's the manioc root. If any of you are old enough to remember when your mothers had the wooden boxes of Argo starch with a slide top, nice big irregular chunks of white starch, you just put a few in a basin, a little cold water, then pour boiling water, let it cook till it's clear, and starched your clothes. That's the way we did in the good old days always. We didn't have spray starches and all these things. Well, that Oswego starch is nothing but pure gozo, manioc root. And that's what the African women do. They have to soak that 3 days to get the outer bark and prussic acid out of it. Then dry it in the sun. Then when they're ready, they beat in their poo to make those lumps into powder. Then they have the big pot of boiling water and sit with their hand and stir and stir. So if it were clean, it would come clear. but instead it's a dirty gray, funny looking stuff, but a thick ball. And they just pick a chunk off that and dip through the sauce of green leaves. That's their food. Can you imagine what it would be to eat pure starch without a speck of salt? You try macaroni sometime with no salt at all and it can taste mighty flat. Janali had been in the soldiers' visit village a good part of her life. She'd had a weekly ration of meat and salt. It was hard to get used to eating without. But what could I give a woman to do? I'd train boys to work at the house. I'd train boys to do the washing and ironing. I had boys to help in the dispensary. I said, Janali, I can't think of a thing. The only thing I need help in, I'd be ashamed to ask you to do it. She says, what is it? Who does it now? I said, well, I do. Well, she said, if you can do it, why couldn't I? And I says, but Janali, it's washing out the old bandages. In those days, we depend entirely upon the bandages from rolled sheets. Maybe some of you have gotten pretty tired of rolling them someday. Well, how do you like the job of washing them out after they've been on a dirty old tropical ulcer for a week, all matted with pus and blood? But I was running out of them. So I fixed a big tub of Lysol solution. And I'd take with my forceps and take the bandage off and drop it in the Lysol solution. And I'll admit some days it lay there, sometimes 3 days, before I got the courage to get down there and wash it out. Janali took that over. She took real pride in getting those bandages white and rolling them up neatly. Then came the time my daughters came back as missionaries. One of them's a nurse and one a school teacher. Arlene says, Mama, you've wanted to get to building the hospital now so long and you couldn't. Because I didn't have anybody take care of the dispensary. She says, you turn over the dispensary to me and you get to the construction work. I said, nothing would suit me better. So I did. About 3 weeks later, Arlene came and she says, Mama, do you mean to tell me you sat up at night with your delivery cases? And I said, yes. She says, the women tell me you stayed with them all night lots of times. What did you do it for? She said, it was you taught me how to examine them and to know whether it would be hours yet or soon or how. Why didn't you examine them? And if you knew it was a long time, go home and go to bed. I said, honey, it's something you wouldn't understand now. But a woman in labor doesn't like to be left all alone. And I said, besides, I've led far more women to Christ on the delivery table than I ever have in the chapel or in class. And she said, well, maybe you could take it, but I can't. I'm no good the next day when I don't get my sleep. And I said, well, honey, you take it daytimes and I'll take it night. She says, you will not. That isn't what I come for. I said, did you have something in mind? She said, yes, I'd like to train a midwife. I says, oh, you know how it happened with me. I had tried 6 different young women. I'd made them lovely uniforms. I had given them soap and taught them to wash and clean their nails and be so careful. Just when I'd get them to the place, they would be a real help. Some white man would come along and take them. And the poor, silly girls thought they were marrying them. Of course, they would just take them as concubines till they would go on furlough. Or till they'd get pregnant and they'd leave them. But you couldn't tell the girls that. They all went off with them. I said, I gave up. And she said, oh, I wouldn't waste my time with any of the young women. I'd like to train a widow. And I said, did you have somebody in mind? She said, yes, I'd like Janali. I said, "Why, honey, Janali's an old woman." She says, "Look who's talking. I wouldn't be surprised if you're old enough to be her mother." Well, African women are much younger than us in comparison, but there's all that difference of training. And I said, "Well, if you want to try, why take her?" Well, Arlene took Janali and taught her. Janali has been the midwife at our dispensary for over 13 years. And oh, what a blessing she's been. I'll always remember one day, I finally got the hospital done. We have 3 doctors and laboratory technician and a dentist. I'd been assisting in surgery that day, and we were late. When I came back, the dispensary was all closed. But here sat Janali out on the front veranda. And I says, "Well, Janali, isn't this your time off? Why don't you go home and rest? Have you had your lunch?" She says, "Mama, do you mind if I sit here?" And I says, "Well, of course not, but I think you'd be ready to rest." And she says, "But Mama, this is the time the women go by to the spring to draw water. And if they see me sitting here alone, some of them will come over and talk to me. Just last week, I led 3 to Christ." I says, "Now you can stay just whenever you want." But as I look back at the ministry of Janali, and the many that she has led to Christ, women that have gained their self-respect, women that have amounted to something and gone out to serve the Lord because Janali adorned the doctrine of God. Just a minute. "Exhort servants to be obedient unto their own masters and to please them well in all things, not answering again." I don't know how many of you have had servants, if your patience has been tried with them answering again. But many a time I wanted to give up. I thought it'd be easier to do everything myself than try to train those boys. I remember when I decided to teach them to do the washing and ironing. We just had big tubs. Gasoline drums were cut in half, sat out in the backyard, and they carried the water up to the yard to do the washing. I'd show them, I'd sort the clothes myself, and show them which was to be washed first, the white clothes, then the color, then Mr. Laird's work khakis. Invariably, always when I come out, it'd be Mr. Laird's khakis that were in the water the first thing. And oh, how he loved to wash his things. Mr. Laird always changed into white duck in the afternoon, had white linen for Sunday. That boy could starch and iron those to perfection. He didn't care how many wrinkles were in my dresses or what they looked like. I think they dreamed themselves into Miss Sears' clothes, and it's a joy to be just so-so. But I'd tell him and go through it again. And you know that boy that had never had clothes to wear in his life or washed clothes before would stand up and tell me how it ought to be done? And it took all the patience in the world. Servants not answering again. But I wonder how many of us answer back to Christ. When he shows us through his word what he wants us to do, are we quick to say, "Yes, Lord," and to go do it the way he's shown us in the word? I don't know about you, but I found myself guilty of arguing with the Lord that I could do something else better. Not cheating. Well, of course we wouldn't cheat. We're Christians. Let them have their cheating scandals down at the Air Force Academy. But just a minute. Ye are not your own. Ye are bought with a price, even the blood of Jesus Christ. Therefore, glorify him in your body and in your soul, which are his. Are you living entirely for Christ today? If you're making provision for the flesh, if you prefer things of the world, you're cheating. God help us to go home to read these passages again. If we would be women that adorn the doctrine of God, we have to recognize ourselves as servants. Not answering again, not cheating, but showing all good fidelity in all things. God grant us to be faithful handmaids of His.